both in the numbers killed and also in the rather horrific reaction we saw from so many Iraqis in Fallujah. What does that tell you about the state of security in Iraq?
Though every death matters and every person lost is a tragedy, we need to keep in mind that this number of deaths is not out of the realm of what we've been seeing in recent weeks and months. The real key is whether people overreact to the gruesome scene here in America or there in Iraq. There's a political process going on in Iraq, and that's as important as security developments. If these security developments affect either the political process there or here, then we could see a much bigger impact.
What's your assessment of what we saw today?
I think Mr. Orr made a very important point. We saw some horrifying images, but there are now, if you count killed and wounded, close to 4,000 coalition personnel. There have been roughly two deaths a day of people in uniform. And these images are simply deliberate efforts, I think, psychologically to manipulate opinion. We also need to remember, because we may focus on the fact these are Americans,
shut the hell up, you whining, babbling fools. This nonsense about, what we saw today was a horrifying image. What are you talking about? The poor Iraqi man couldn't afford a soccer ball, so he decided to use the burnt-up Americano's head. What's wrong with that? And then you babble out. The image was more to motivate public opinion than anything else. You mean like when the U.S. Empire had its G.I. Joes topple Saddam Hussein's statue over? Like that wasn't trying to manipulate through image. And then you also cry. The real key is whether people overreact in this country. You mean like the bloodthirsty militarists who are already talking about committing all kinds of savage attacks in the Fallujah area? Since those U.S. Marines, U.S. mercenaries got their ass burnt up. Shut the hell up. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this out. Listening to 104.1, 96.3 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, The World, Slave Revolt Time. Tonight we're going to start it off with a Beyond the Shadow segment that deals with a concept that's being thrown around, how Sam should use soft imperialism instead of hard imperialism, in essence. And then if Jiro rolls in, he'll do the news. And then we'll finish it off with a commentary. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt. Oh yeah, and it's become clear, Sam, you just better straighten up and fly right. That's what the world's telling your ass.
Monkey got in trouble in the south one day. Hopped upon a buzzard for the getaway. The buzzard tried to throw the monkey off his back, but the monkey grabbed his neck and said, "Now listen, Jack, straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. Don't you try to flip me down on Mississippi.
hazards relative to the number of attacks.
Mississippi ain't no place to drop. The buzzer told the monkey, you are choking me. Release your hold, and I'll get you free. But the monkey looked the buzzer right dead in the eye and said, like, man, I don't tell that lie. Just straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right. Just keep flying until I say stop. The buzzer begged the monkey over Tennessee. Let me rest a minute in that tree. But the monkey slapped the buzzer right smack in the mouth and said, just keep flying. We are still down south. Don't you try to trick me. Get me out of Dixie. Straighten up and fly right. Else you gonna get another ball. Fly right. Don't you blow your top.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You know what time it is now. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight, what we're going to deal with in this first opening segment is, there's a new book out by a guy named Joe Nye. And he's written a book called Soft Power and A Means to Success in World Politics. So we're going to examine this a little bit, because it sounds like soft power, meaning soft imperialism, quote unquote, versus hard imperialism, and what that really means in the real world for the average people under the flamethrower of the U.S. empire. So, to deal with this hard power, soft power, Orwellian speak, we're first gonna let the author of the book, Joe Nye, who is talking to Neil Cohen, he's a NPR host on Talk of the Nation, we're going to let him explain exactly what he means about that concept of soft power, and when and how the U.S. Empire should use it. So, check this out, and we'll take it from there. Dig this.
But power is very much dependent upon the context. I mean, we think of various resources that produce power, but when the context changes, they change. Tanks are great, the hard power resource in the desert. They're not much good in a swamp. Or to think of it historically, uranium was a power resource after the nuclear age. Before that, it was just a nuisance.
And similarly, economic power, sanctions might be useful against in a situation like South Africa, for instance, during apartheid, but less successful, obviously, against a transnational foe like Al-Qaeda.
That's right. And even against countries, we find that economic sanctions only work from somewhere between a third to a half of the cases where they've been tried. So it's easy to see your results usually with military power. You either win or lose a battle fairly quickly, though there are exceptions to that. It took a long time to lose the Vietnam War, a decade. But generally speaking, you see the results much more quickly. Economic power, somewhat in between. Soft power often takes quite some time.
You point out a case of human rights policies in the Carter administration in your book. that you say had some unusual echoes some years afterwards.
That's right. I remember going to Buenos Aires with Secretary of State Cyrus Vance when I was in the Carter administration, and the United States was very unpopular for beating up on the Argentine government about human rights. But when I went back in 1991 as a visitor, the United States was wildly popular. And the reason is because the people who were having their fingernails torn out in the 1970s when we were complaining about it were in power in the 1990s. And that actually helped us when we were trying to get support in the UN and for going into the Balkans to deal with the disturbances there. The Argentines were very supportive.
So that that element of soft power in the Carter administration, obviously...
That's right, paid off a couple of decades later.
For the Clinton administration, decades later. Nevertheless, Jimmy Carter's human rights policies may have been a success in soft power. He had some other difficulties with hard power. As you point out, if you fail, as President Carter's and American forces did at Desert One, trying to intervene in Iran, that can cost you prestige and loss of hard power as well.
Absolutely. It's not a question of hard power versus soft power. The two are complementary. And my complaint is with those who think that hard power alone is sufficient. But very often, soft power alone is not sufficient either. The question is, how do you combine the two so that you're a smart power?
All right, it's these guys never quit with this stuff. You know, it's kind of interesting that he first starts off mentioning how soft power was used well in the form of sanctions against the apartheid government, but has not worked as good against a group like Al-Qaeda. Now, dealing with South Africa first, what's fascinating is that the reality is that hard capitalism still exists in South Africa. That's the real world, and that's what's penetrating and devastating the people. And that was something that the rulers in South Africa, the white apartheid rulers, and the various imperialists and pro-marketeers throughout the world never wanted on the agenda as far as a discussion. So making various reforms within a market system is basically shuffling the deck. Jim Crow, just like the apartheid system in South Africa, are basically just scaffolding. You use scaffolding to help you build up the house of inequality within a market system. In other words, it helps the small percentage of rulers within a society privatize their power base even more, segregate it even more, because one, you're dividing the working class population. You're fracturing it up on various strategies, you know, and in the case of South Africa and America, on racial divisions. So you can build the house of apartheid, of super segregated private capital power. You use the scaffolding, i.e. apartheid, to build that house. Once the house has been built and you have everything privatized up and a super disproportional amount of power and influence in a segregated elite's hands, then you can take the scaffolding down because the house of inequality will still stand on its own because capitalism will stand on its own. Now, in the case of South Africa, whites are less than 5% of the population. Yet, whites control well over 80% of the land. They own the best land. So even though, quote-unquote, apartheid officially is down, gone, i.e. legislative forms of apartheid, now the apartheid economic system, which was built in part through the apartheid traditional system, is as rigid as ever. You got black people in some of the townships getting arrested for quote-unquote stealing water, because the segregationists in South Africa were able to privatize various forms of industry, including the water. So now you have a situation where even though apartheid, legislative apartheid, is gone, a corporate conglomerate apartheid is in super existence, and as a result, super poverty is in existence. So the enemy always wants to get us off track on these real issues and get us talking about soft imperialism versus hard imperialism. So if someone doesn't have a sign outwardly showing their racial discrimination against you, then it could be debated whether they're not a whether they are or are not a good person. So in other words, that same person now can work for a bank and just redline your community. But since he's doing it behind closed doors and not running around with a Ku Klux Klan uniform on, then whether that person is really a racist can be. See, this is mysticism talk. Now, you also have the situation where basically they're talking about the carrot and the stick, and often that is used by the imperialist and colonialist classes for various reasons. One, they may be overextended. It may not be in their best interest all the time to use military force and be outwardly bashing people down for internal reason and for external reasons. It's much easier to have a neo-colonialist system going on where you buy off a small ruling elite of a particular country after you've disciplined the people within that country, that to go for any form of alternative system, well, there's going to be hell to pay. So then at that point in time, you can use quote-unquote soft imperialism or soft power, as this, Joseph Nye guy was talking about. But next, let's go into how a caller, Morgie, challenges this soft versus hard power position of Joe Nye and says, what does this really mean when you're not talking about real justice, like I was mentioning in essence about what's going on in South Africa? So let's see how Nye responds to this. Check this out.
And, let's begin with Moji, and Moji joins us on the phone from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, I want to make the basic point that power, we don't have soft or hard power, we have power. The only difference is that when power is divorced from morality, from justice, then it becomes the law of the jungle. And that's the basic thing. I mean, all the other, with all due respect to your guest, very fine analysis of modes of practicing power. But we're dealing with power itself. And power, whether it is disguised or whether it is finesse into public relations and PR, doesn't matter. When power is applied, it needs to be applied. It needs to be not applied. It needs to have in itself, in its own nature, a very, very connected for empowerment, a very, very deeply interconnected relationship with justice and with morality. And when it is, as in the, specifically in the case of the so-called war on terrorism and the so-called war in Iraq, when power is applied nakedly without any relationship to real morality and real justice, then it becomes the law of the jungle.
Do you see, Moji, that the United States applied military power in Afghanistan to attack the Taliban and Al-Qaeda without justice, without morality?
Well, Yes, in the sense that it was the Taliban was put in power by the U.S. and also the Ba'ath Party, the, you know, going back to after the beginning of the Hassan al-Bakr rule, it was the CIA that put Saddam Hussein in power. So we can't, you know, we can't have it both ways.
Well, we're going to have some disagreement, I suspect, on the facts. So what about Moji's point?
Well, the basic point, I mean, that's power is the ability to get others to do the things you want. And it can be used for good or bad purposes. Bad people can have soft power. For example, bin Laden has soft power among a number of extreme Muslims. If you look at the recent Pew polls, you find that more people trust bin Laden in Pakistan and in Jordan than trust the United States. So you can have power. Soft power is not good or bad. It's just a form of power, and it can be used for good purposes or bad purposes.
So morality is not an element of it? Or?
Well, morality, if you have a moral cause, you're more likely to attract others, and that's likely to enhance your soft power. So if you look at, for example, Gandhi was very effective tactically in getting what he wanted, getting the British out of India, because he not only used soft power instead of hard power, but that was seen as moral. Same thing with Martin Luther King in the United States. Indeed, sometimes it's interesting to play historically with the fact that if Yasser Arafat had chosen the soft power approach of Gandhi rather than the hard power of guerrilla warfare, I bet there'd be a Palestinian state now.
Now you know that this dude has just lost his mind and is just spinning propaganda. Now, just last week, you know, I did a thing on, you know, the whole Palestine-Israel historical connection. And from the various, from the very beginning, the onset, Theodore Hirsch and all of them, what they were trying to create, it was clear that they did not envision an Israel-Palestine with Palestinians. And they made it clear through their declarations. And also the role that world imperialism was playing when you have Britain cutting deals with France, the Palestinian people, if they helped them during the World War, and then also the Zionists. So the British were making deals with all three, and all of them contradicted the various people's intentions. So you have this type of madness going on. And this guy, what he's trying to do, what he wants to do, is just act like basically Israel is operating out of a humane platform in the same way that Britain was operating in basically a humane platform in the same way that Sam was. And what I mean by that is that what he said was Gandhi's success, more or less King's success. So as if there wasn't other reasons for some of the things that the various regions in where these people live, as if there wasn't certain reasons for some concessions for some of the things that were ascertained during those periods. And as long as you approach Sam correctly, i.e. non-violently in the case of King, Britain in the case of Gandhi, and then if only Arafat had done the same to Israel, then things would have worked out much better. And I mean, this is rhetoric. Now the decline of Britain's empire and the fact that Britain had suffered a defeat in Iraq during that same period of time had strong ramifications on its decline of power. In the same way that when the Haitians defeated both the Britons and the French, this weakened up France's stronghold in imperialist outlook, and they ended up conceding a deal to the U.S. Empire over the Louisiana, the state or the region that became Louisiana. So what I'm saying is that the reason why the U.S. expansionist empire got Louisiana wasn't because they approached the French right. These were both expansionist societies. It was because of what the French had suffered in Haiti. These play into all expanding empires and regions that basically have expanded through brute force in the first place. So this is just trying to create a whole nother reality that just does not exist. Now, you'll notice that Neil Cohen character also tried to play it like the Bath Party. And when the guy mentioned that the Bath Party was a creation of the CIA and the Taliban was a creation of the CIA, you notice how Neil Cohen said, well, we're going to have some disagreements on the facts, without of course going into the fact that the U.S. obviously, clearly played a role in creating the Mujahideen, which later in part formed into the Taliban, and the U.S. Had no problem with the Taliban until, the whole thing with the pipeline deal just couldn't be ironed out, and that the U.S. had supported Saddam Hussein and contacted him back in the 1950s, when they wanted to have someone counter to the Iraqi president at the time in the 50s, who was one of the architects of OPEC, which of course Sam was not all that pleased about. So leaving out these little facts and just saying, we have a little disagreement on the facts, without going into the fact that Sam was using some of his soft power intelligence connections in helping Saddam rise to power, and using some of his soft power intelligence connections and allowing them to help operate with the ISI in helping create who we know as Osama bin Laden, helping give military training to these fanatics, to give the Soviet Union, in the words of Brzezinski, to give the Soviet Union its Vietnam. So a soft power, as he admitted to, can be used in vicious ways. Now, of course, he doesn't want you to think that or believe that the U.S. will, of course, would use it in those ways, because we're supposed to be under some illusion that countries like Britain, the U.S., Israel, are here basically in some kind of noble, unifying way. Of course, problems will come about sometimes, but overall, there's good intentions. Now, this is how this type of rhetoric and propaganda gets people to believe that Sam's intentions on using soft war strategies in issues like, let's say, the WTO are not what they are. In other words, you have a situation where the WTO is used as a way of corporate expansionism for the first world's domination, especially over the rest of the world and over the regions that all people live in. Now, the ramifications of this we've already seen, where we've seen a deterioration of the various standards of food safety, water safety, what is allowed in gasoline, etc., etc. Now, this can all be fit into the framework of soft power, but this soft form of corporate imperialism is having a devastating impact and continues throughout the world. Now, also, it's clear that so-called hard power and hard resistance is not all that bad at times strategically when you're coming up against a vicious empire like the U.S. Because it's clear that if those like Che and them had not used some hardcore resistance against Batista, they would have been wiped off the map. And everything that Sam stands for would have still been deeply regimented in Cuba. And instead of Cuba having one of the higher standards of living in South America, it would have basically been like most of the other countries in South America, the South American region, basically a basket case. What if the Haitian Revolution had tried to come at the French and the British slavers? These were slavers who had wanted to maintain them in the slaveocracy system. What if they had tried to come to the French or the British with a Gandhian approach? Well, I think we know the answer to that. So, but next, Neil Cohen asked the author Joe Nye about the legitimacy of power. So let's see how these two deal with this, and we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Is legitimacy an element of power?
Absolutely. People follow others when they think that they're legitimate, when they're attractive. And if your policies are seen as legitimate by others, you're more likely to attract others.
Can hard power itself generate soft power if you're seen as invincible?
Stalin and Hitler both tried that, by having a myth of invincibility to become attractive to others, and that can be a source of soft power. Though it's worth noticing historically that the Soviet Union had a lot of soft power after World War II. They were the opponents of fascism during the war. Communism was actually quite popular in Europe, between France and Italy after World War II. But the Soviets squandered that soft power by the way they used their hard power to invade Hungary and Czechoslovakia. So their hard power continued to grow, but the way they used it made their soft power decline.
All right. Now, when he says that people will follow your soft power and your power in general if they think it's legitimate, in essence, this is what he's trying to do, legitimatize Sam's imperial power mechanism. Sam's right for domination of the planet, because the whole platform of the discussion has started off and is based off the fact that we're supposed to accept the legitimacy of Sam, of the U.S. Empire. And that within itself starts one off on a platform that is not level and it's not based in reality. So once you start off on this unlevel platform, then you can just be spinning this rhetoric basically till the end of time, which is basically what he wants you to do. Now next, this guy Ken from Cleveland asked, does the bad press Sam's getting, is this eroding its soft power concepts? So let's see what they have to say. Check this out.
Another caller in. Ken joins us on the line from Cleveland.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, interesting concept. I was just wondering yesterday with our current war on Iraq and bad press we've been getting throughout, Muslim nations, that would seem like it would decrease our soft power and actually make it harder for our, U.S. intelligence agencies to, make friends with people and collect human intelligence. Wouldn't it, be harmful, for the country as a whole, depending on, which kind of power we used?
I think that's exactly right. If you take Indonesia, which is the largest Islamic country in the world, in 2000, the poll showed that 3/4 of Indonesians had a favorable view of the U.S. After the Iraq War, that declined to 15%, 1/5. That's an extraordinary drop. But we need the cooperation of Indonesians to deal with Jamaah Islamiyah and other offshoots of Al-Qaeda. To some extent, they'll cooperate with us out of their own self-interest. But the degree of cooperation has a lot to do with how attractive or unattractive we are.
So once again, basically, he's talking about propaganda. And there's no concept of, as I mentioned initially, and also how that caller, Moji, was talking about any form of concept of any kind of true form of human or social justice. In other words, any type of alliance you can make, even if it's with some ruthless dictator in whatever country, it's all okay if they're able to maintain their population and propaganda and so on and so forth. This is what I mean by this is basically soft imperialism and slash hard imperialism. The carrot and the stick is still trying to bend people under the U.S. domination and way of life. Now, to go in and test some of the waters of how this soft power slash hard power concept works, we're gonna deal with this sister from Turkey named Sybil Edmondson. She's been a resident in America for about 10 years. She speaks Turkish, Arabic, and Farsi. She worked for the FBI. And she outlines what Boy George and the intelligence apparatus knew pre-911 about the terror attacks that were about to unfold. So let's check out what she has to say and connect it to some of this soft and hard power rhetoric that exists.
The past 2 years, I have testified several times for the Department of Justice Inspector General and for the Senate Judiciary Committee. And a few months ago, I testified behind closed doors for the 9/11 Commission. And as I stated before, to just come out and say and state that we had no specific information whatsoever, that would be an outrageous lie. President Bush, I guess he made a smart move because he also added that they did not have any specific information stating that the attack was going to occur on September 11th. But Ms. Rice's statement that we had no specific information is inaccurate. I would say not only that we had specific information, we had several specific information as early as April 2001. And many of this information has been public already. I mean, you look at what Agent Rowley provided. You look at Phoenix Memo. The investigations that I work at after 9/11, retranslating certain documents related to certain investigations, that is the reason I'm saying this is absolutely inaccurate. We had not one, but we had many specific information, and this information was not maybe investigated under counterterrorism because it's very difficult to separate these issues when you have a criminal investigation, a money laundering investigation, drug-related investigation that actually have major information regarding 9/11 incidents. And to say that they would be mostly under counterterrorism would be a wrong assumption, too.
Now, what this sister lays out helps connect in many ways Sam's viciousness and in many ways, even though it wasn't supposed to be connected, wipes out this whole illusion of soft power versus hard power rhetoric that this Joe Nye was saying. And what I mean by that is that, the U.S. has long laid out, even before PNAC, that many people like to go on and on about now, which is an important document by those little, you know, neocons and stuff like that. But there's long been laid out the Silk Road strategy and Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, which talked about the next global moves for SAM and who its competitors were going to be, players like China and Russia, so on and so forth, and what must be done to consolidate SAM's power, expansionist power, especially in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. So these things have long been discussed, played out, talked about, written about, etc. Now, the reason why I mentioned this was that here is Seville. She's talking about how the U.S. Empire knew that these hits were coming. Now, they allowed them to happen. Once they happened, then what did the rulers in this society do? They turned around and, to use Joe Nye's words, they basically said to the American public, look, we've tried this soft power strategy against Iraq, but it didn't work, i.e. sanctions, even though these soft power strategies cost 1.7 million lives, at least, of the Iraqi people, mainly kids. And remember back at the time when at least 400,000 kids had evaporated, and the ambassador was asked under Prime Bill Clinton's administration, is the price worth it? And she made the legendary statements that yes, her, Miss Albright, believed that they were worth it. That was soft power. That was a soft power strategy. And in part, it was legitimatized, quote unquote, by the whole UN farce, which is basically, another mechanism to help give legitimacy to the whole state apparatus concepts, which are then used as a battering ram against the masses of people. Now, to finish up on that aspect of what I was saying, so the rulers come and say, look, we've tried these soft power strategies against Iraq. They scoffed at them. They've ignored them. And actually, they plan on using hard power against us. It's imminent. The threat's imminent. And based off of that, they then legitimize, quote unquote, in a sense, their use of hard power. So in other words, imperialism was always a factor. Whether it's soft imperialism or hard imperialism, it still causes death and destruction, and its whole intention is domination with no form or pretense in the real world of real or human social justice. Now next, let's go back to Neil Cohen, host of Talk of the Nation, as he asked Joe Nye next about the different levels of power Sam has to deal with. So let's see what Nye has to say about this, and we'll take it from there. Check this out.
I wanted to ask you, because of these different levels of power that you talk about, and economic level, again, where there are more than one node. The United States may have the largest economy, but the Europeans, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Russians all certainly have a voice in all of that. And this bottom, more chaotic level of soft power, you say that this makes nonsense of the idea of an American empire.
Well, it doesn't make much sense to talk of an American empire when you can't control things. I mean, the whole idea of empire is that you have control. But we really don't have control. You know, this is a country that couldn't even get the votes of Canada, Mexico, and Chile last year when we were asking for their votes in the UN before we went into Iraq. That's hard to call that an empire.
So if it's necessary to balance all of these different elements of power in terms of who's wielding it, the people at the top, have we gotten out of balance, do you think?
I think we're out of balance. I think what happened is when the Cold War ended, the American people wanted the peace dividend. We cut back enormously on what we spent on international exchange programs, on broadcasting, on things that developed.
Voice of America.
Voice of America, exactly. And that happened right after the Cold War in the Clinton administration. But then when the Bush administration came in, they not only didn't restore that those cuts, but they also had a rather unilateralist, some would say arrogant policy, which again made us unpopular. The net result is that the combination of policy and investments, we're not as popular as we used to be. Now, people say popularity is ephemeral, it doesn't matter. But let me tell you, when you become so unpopular that you're the kiss of death in the domestic politics in another country, it can hurt you.
Okay, once again, through all the smoke and mirrors, I think you get an element of fear in the truth of what he's really about. When he says that, you know, Sam is not as popular as he once was, and how that can hurt you. In essence, in the real world speak, you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the decline of the left and other radical movements throughout the world, the third world especially has been made a wasteland, and the U.S. has been able to take off the corks even more so that it has stuck on its fangs, and now has basically been revealing its fangs and penetrating without the cork on its fangs even more so throughout the planet. Its raw dogness is more blatant than ever, is what I'm saying. And its willingness to concede certain issues, to accommodate other world powers, has been relaxed because of the fact that it, one, sees its personal need to expand as much power as much as possible for its own global domination, to ward off any future possible challengers, and two, because it's trying to seize the opportunity that has been left in the vacuum of the collapse of some of the other recent historical competing forces. So it's just become more blatant. Now, what this has caused is that many of its former allies and friends, Frankenstein monsters, it's basically been able to cut loose. And many people who've had certain illusions in certain regions of the world no longer have those illusions. So when, you know, the people in Panama, at one time, their little commando, Noriega, who got training at the School of the Americas by Sam, when Sam didn't need him anymore, he just kicked him to the curb. The same thing has happened to Saddam and others. Bin Laden, you know. So Sam has just become more aggressive and blatant because of the changing dialects of the world today. So within that matrix, many people on Sam's global plantation, views of Sam have soured. Now, as far as you know, him saying that Sam is not an empire and stuff like that, because they can't. And, I mean, first of all, you know, empires don't just have complete domination over every single thing. That's impossible. But they do have an exorbitant amount of influence and use these various influences. Now, when you look at how Sam was able to get condemned internationally in world court for international terrorism against the Nicaraguan people, but there was no consequence to the empire for that. What it was able to do in Iraq against all forms of opposition worldwide, the majority of the people on the planet were against Sam's going in and occupying Iraq. There's no other nation on the planet today that could have gotten away with doing what Sam did as far as its invasion into Iraq, because no other nation could have withstood the economic threats and possible threats of military intervention if they had gone in like that. But Sam could. That's the context of Sam's imperial power and influence that it should be put in. Not this, you know, rhetoric about Sam ain't got no power, you know, no influence and all of that. But once again, let's see how this hard slash soft power rhetoric works in the real world. On CNN's Crossfire, the two hosts with two guests of theirs discuss the what power tactics should be taken for the four Americanos that were recently killed in the Fallujah city of Iraq. So let's see how this discussion of soft or hard power is discussed amongst one of the Imperial networks and Imperial shows, Crossfire, on CNN. Check this out.
For the next 9 hours, those bodies were desecrated in the streets of Fallujah, and the military did nothing to stop the desecration. Asked why, a military spokesman yesterday, Colonel Michael Walker, who's in Iraq, had this to say about the most offensive thing I think I've heard this week. Quote, should we have sent in a tank so we could have gotten, with all due respect, four dead bodies back? What good would that have done? It seems to me that if there was ever a cause worth dying for, it's preventing American bodies from being desecrated on television. Don't you think that's true?
Well, obviously, the spokesman was very callous in what he said. That was inappropriate, and unfortunately, it compacts the already inappropriate behavior of what happened in Fallujah. So, rushing in may not have been the right thing. I think there was a Marine colonel on, or Marine general, also got interviewed and said, but there could have been a trap involved, and that's correct. And that's often an insurgent.
Let me finish.
It's often an insurgent tactic is you shoot somebody and then you just wait there for the rescue team to show up and then you ambush them. So I think they were smart to wait.
Well, nobody doubts it's dangerous in Fallujah. And leaving aside the question whether we even want to live in a country that allows its citizens to be hacked apart with shovels, my question is, what message do you think it sends to the families of these men who saw their mutilations on television, to the insurgents in Iraq who can do this with impunity, and to the American people who now know their government doesn't care enough to prevent their bodies from being desecrated?
Well, that's all the more reason why we should be going into Fallujah and doing a massive response to the city, to demonstrate to the city as a whole that we are doing things. But it has to be done very carefully. It has to be targeted at the people that have done things wrong and not targeted at other people, not targeted at innocents, because we don't want to become the people that they are, or they have demonstrated they are.
Kelly, you are one of those contractors risking your life for American policy in Iraq. You took my friend Tucker over there for one of the braver pieces of journalism I've read in a long time. What should we do in retaliation for the murder of these Americans and the mutilation of their bodies?
Well, there should be retaliation. In fact, the division commander has actually said, General Mattis, we'd be your best friend and your worst enemy. And I think they're going to taste a little bit about what it is to be their worst enemy. Problem is, it has to be ethical. It has to be focused. It has to be tightly controlled. I think what you'll probably see, Paul, is they're going to shut that city down. They're going to employ snipers, maybe enforce some kind of martial law so that if you're on the street after 8 o'clock, they're going to be subject to being killed. But it won't be left unchecked. The problem is there are rules to war. And in fact, you can't be murderers. If you think about the situation right after that happened, there was a mob scene. Who to shoot? You can't shoot into the crowd. I mean, you can't basically go into a fire sack where you basically come in and the entree is to another Mogadishu type event. The fact is they had an RPV, a remotely piloted vehicle, up. They saw what they could. There had been no previous coordination. In fact, they didn't even know who those people were initially and what they were doing. So tactically on the ground, what it seems to be the case isn't the same thing assumptions are made when people watch TV. You think, well, we just run like hell out there and get these guys. It doesn't work like that. It could end up more dead.
It seems to me, though, Kelly, just follow up on that. I mean, the Marines weren't the only people who didn't act. There were Iraqi national policemen,
lots of them
within Fallujah. They did, of course, nothing except cower. Here's a quote from one of them from the Kansas City Star today, Muhammad El-Assawi. He said, quote, we had to stay away. What happened was between Americans and insurgents. If we got involved, we would have been killed.
who's going to take care of my kids then? I guess my question is, what's the point of having an Iraqi National Police Force if they don't do anything except run away?
One would wonder.
Well, what do you think the point of it is?
I think that the point of it is that they can't control and have shown an unwillingness yet to control this kind of activity. I think that when they're deployed with their American counterparts, the international police monitors, they'll have to be made to do good policing. They'll have to be made to interject themselves into their community and to stand up with authority. The fact is, right now, Iraqi people don't trust their police. They have an adversarial relationship.
Well, I don't trust them either.
The system's broken.
Okay, you know, here we go again. The crossfire, the reason why I don't point out, like, who's supposed to be on the left and who's supposed to be on the right is because in reality you can't tell, because it's clear that they're both right-wingers and they're talking to both supporters of the state, i.e. two right-wingers themselves. So basically it was a discussion of four right-wing militarists who believe in the legitimacy of the domination of the U.S. empire. And it basically came out in their rhetoric. But let's use the construct of Joe Nye for a second and their soft power, his soft power construct. When the host asked one of the guests, what's the point of having an Iraqi police force if they're just going to run away? In other words, what's the point of using soft power? Because that's what the Iraqi police force is there for. It's a creation of the imperialist class to get its goals, maintain its goals in Iraq through another vehicle other than itself. In other words, instead of it having to use its own soldiers and mercenaries in the future, they want to set up the police force indigenous to Iraq that will do its bidding so that it will maintain the proper order in Iraq for the Halliburtons of the world, for the oil conglomerates, the U.S. oil, for all of the privatization mechanisms that are going in place. That's considered, in essence, part of the soft power strategy. Don't use your own forces in the end. You want to have your own Mobutus and the police forces that are set up there indigenously, that you've trained and helped set up and you've picked and organized along with the whole state apparatus that that they're trying to create in Iraq. So basically they're talking about a soft power strategy, but the soft power strategy has not worked, and it's and the soft power strategy is shaking in its boots in the city of Fallujah. So now what they're talking about, so now what these crossfire guys are complaining about is, well, look, if our soft power technicians can't help keep order, then we're just going to have to go in there and raw dog it ourselves, i.e. use the U.S. military killing machine. Now, they basically talk about this openly when one of the mercenaries says that, well, now they're about to taste, the people of Fallujah, what it means, says that, well, now they're about to taste, the people of Fallujah, what it means to be Sam's worst energy, worst enemy. What they'll probably do is shut down the city, put in martial law, and set up snipers. Now, here you have a situation where probably a handful of people were involved in this assassination of these mercenaries, and that's what they were. These guys were U.S. mercenaries. These guys were ex-like Navy SEAL guys who were getting paid upwards to $15,000 a month. And since the U.S. Army since there's a privatization aspect going on in all aspects of the world economy and within this society also, you have a situation where many aspects of the military and former militarists are privatizing their talents out. Now, there's at least 15,000 mercenaries. With these 15,000 mercenaries, militarists privatized hired guns over in Iraq, that's more military personnel in the, than Britain has. So you have the number one amount of military is the U.S. military, which is through the whole government, public sector. Then the next highest amount is private mercenaries from the U.S., from South Africa, etc., etc. This is so look, they were just enemy combatants, and they got waxed like enemy combatants. But as a result of that, so basically what I'm saying is they're in reality part of the hard power structure. But now, since they got waxed down, these guys on Crossfire are talking about now it's time for to shut down the city, martial law. Anyone who's out after a certain amount of time is subject to be killed. So a handful of people were involved. Another handful of people were involved in a celebration and basically doing some of the traditional American values things that have happened to black people by white people within this society. I'm about to speak on this for a second because, you know, some of these clowns acting like this was the worst thing that they've ever seen and or imagined is quite amazing. You know, there's even books. There's a Lynch book that's basically on Lynch postcards. And it goes into all these various graphic things. But for the most part, they're pages, a history, and photographs of postcard lynchings. In other words, when they would find a Negro, any Negro, lynch a Negro, often in these various cities and states, they after they would burn up your corpse and, you know, cut your, you know, lips out if you were a pregnant woman, cut your baby out of your stomach, stomp on it, burn it up, stuff like that. They would often take pictures of it, not just for their own prosperity purposes, and, you know, pose and buy it and all of that type of stuff, but also to, they would, there was an economic marketing aspect going on. They would make postcards out of them. So you can go down to your local dime store and get, you know, postcards of the burnt lynch corpse in, that happened in your neighborhood, circle your face and your kid's face if you happen to be at the lynching, and then you would send off these postcards of the lynched person to, you know, your relatives on, you know, Christmas Day. You know, they were used as regular holiday postcards, greeting cards, etc. This became deeply part of the American culture, and it wasn't uncommon for even body parts, charred body parts of burnt black people to be sold in jars at, you know, the local store. In other words, they find, you know, some black person, lynch him up for breaking the law, like reckless eyeballing, which meant that was a law where if you looked at a white woman as a black male in a way that she thought that was sexually provocative, she can charge you with reckless eyeballing. And then, you know, the sheriff will come arrest you if you didn't shoot him down like you should have. And then later that night, a bunch of traditional American values Christians would come, you know, take you out, cut off your ears and cut off your genitals, you know, gouge your eyes out, other traditional things like that, and, you know, burn you up as they lynch you and stuff. Then break your body up into little pieces after it's all charred up. Sometimes some people just tie you up to the back of a car, drive around, body parts would fall off, stuff like that. But the collectors, the marketers, you know, some of these guys who were entrepreneurs, you know, they knew a good thing when they saw it, because these charred black bones and pieces were often valuable commodities to much of the white masses. So they would gather up these parts, put them in jars and what have you, and sell them. And they would sell like hotcakes. This is the real world. And we're not talking about something during Roman time. We're talking about these things happen in the living lifespan of people who are still alive today. There are people who are still alive today who saw these things happen to their own sisters and brothers, mothers, what have you. So it's just through an intentional form of denial and a selective memory that these fools, these real savages in this society, could jump up and act like this is such a gas, and this could happen, this could not possibly happen in this fine savage nation. Man, they're out of their mind. This is games that fools are trying to play. Now, you heard one of the cowards on Crossfire also yap about his disgust at some of the Marine guys or commanders saying that, you know, they may be walking into a trap, you know, why would they go in there now and all of this type of stuff, to retrieve four bodies and stuff. The little coward on Crossfire saying, you know, what does this, what message is this sending out? You know, that our government doesn't care? You know, part of the reason this has also shocked many knuckleheads in this society is because many clowns have helped fall into the trap of Sam through its corporate media spectrum that things are more or less working themselves out. This has been the constant spin that Sam and through his corporate media have been spinning out, that things are working themselves out. Look, they've got these few people who are going to be part of the new government, and all of this type of stuff. Now, what's fascinating is that, you know, sometimes a picture does say 1,000 words or more. And one of the shots that was seen, not on purpose, but they just, when they were filming and showing some of the filming on CNN, about what happened. They showed the burning cars, and you see some of the people celebrating. One of the cameramen was focusing on some of the people who were celebrating. And right behind the person was a giant, giant mural of Saddam Hussein. The mural was untouched. It looked like it had just been polished, like they're polishing it every day. Now, the reason why I mention this is that the image that they were given about the Iraqi people was that the Iraqi people were only too happy to tear down or help tear down all the statues, all the pictures of this tyrant, and so on and so forth. But here, that one picture said it all. Not that necessarily these people were, sad to see Saddam go or anything like that, but often this was this propaganda stuff done by some of their collaborators, pulling down pictures, pulling down statues and stuff like that.
Now, I bet that if there was a statue to Boy George up there, or Bremer, or Wolfowitz, or Colon Cancer Powell, I bet that would have also been on fire. As a matter of fact, one guy called for Bush to come on down. So, but the whole image, once again, was not only that people were so glad to see Saddam go, but the image that they couldn't wait for for Sam's military to get in there. Now, next on Crossfire, the host asked, was Boy George in some kind of haze about how Sam would be accepted? So let's see how some of the guests and others deal with this simple question. And we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Maybe Bill, let me ask you this. Sure. First off, I'm not in the position of second best commanders in the field. So when you guys are here, Kelly, say there will be retribution, I take you at your word and I look forward to it. But I am in a position to second guess policymakers in Washington. I used to be one on domestic policy. I understand a little bit about how foreign policy is made. Our vice president helped lead us into this war by making the following statement on Meet the Press on March 16th of last year. He told Tim Russert, when Tim asked him about whether he would be face opposition after we liberated Iraq, he said, "No, I think things have gotten so bad inside Iraq under Saddam Hussein. From that standpoint of the Iraqi people, my belief is we will in fact be greeted as liberators." He went on to say, "I really do believe we will be greeted as liberators. The read we get on the people of Iraq is there's no question but what they want to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and they will welcome as liberators the United States when you come to do that." Was he hopelessly naive or intentionally misleading us?
I don't want to say the word hopelessly naive, but obviously that he was not correct when he said that they weren't going to be greeted as liberators. And I think part of it had to do with the first Gulf War, when in fact the people did rise up to greet the Americans, especially in the Shia populations in the South. And I think that left a preconception that that would happen again. And in fact, they were put down so forcefully that they were afraid to rise up. And same with the surrenders of the armies. The armies, all they wanted to do in the first Gulf War was surrender as soon as they possibly could.
But wouldn't it have been prudent for policymakers to say, "I hope we'll be greeted as liberators, but hope is not a strategy. So we're going to go in there with a force that will pacify that country, and then we won't have to worry about whether we hope that we're treated as liberators." Wouldn't it be an enormous mistake for the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, to just hope that we'd be treated as liberators?
Well, I think that they had reason to believe that they would be treated as liberators. Saddam Hussein obviously was unpopular, but again, so what these people are fighting against no longer is Saddam Hussein. It has nothing to do with Saddam Hussein. But at that time, I believe that he made an estimate that was, evidence was that was correct. Obviously, it didn't work out the way he hoped it was, but I think it was, based on the information available to him, I think it was a good estimate.
Now, Kelly?
Now, basically, these are two knuckleheads making excuses for hardcore power and imperialism, hard imperialism. First, you have the host, one of the hosts of Crossfire, ask about Boy George misleading his administration, misleading the public, which of course was true, about how Sam would be greeted once they entered into Iraq. But at the same time, what he leaves out is his involvement as part of the Fourth Estate, as part of the corporate military media apparatus, how they also helped give the impression that there was a legitimacy to what Sam was doing. They didn't really challenge Boy George's administration when George and them were, shooting out all of this rhetoric about how they would be have the red carpet rolled out for them once they entered into Iraq, etc., etc. They were a part of creating this illusion to legitimize the imperial ambitions. And as I mentioned before, they had allowed this whole 9-1-1 event to unfold to then use the excuse that our soft imperialism strategy is no longer legit. in trying to get our goals in Iraq. So now we got to go hard power imperialism. See, this is how these guys all operate. They're all about the imperial expansionism policy. And then the host on Crossfire finishes off saying, well, why didn't we just go in there with force, we meaning the U.S. imperial killing machine, to pacify the population? In other words, why didn't we just use total hardcore imperialism all the way through, as if all of that depleted uranium madness that has been thrust out throughout the population, and that has created a situation where 40% of the population may come down with some form of cancer in the years to come, as if that's not hard imperialism. So once again, this is how these guys legitimize imperialism itself. They're basically talking hard versus soft imperialism, just like the author of the book, Joe Nye, did, when at the end of the day, it's all about imperial expansionism and destruction, whether you die softly or hard by it. Now, the other Crossfire host next asks about the possible effect that this may have on the poor little contractors who are going over there and cashing a bullet and other things from time to time. So let's see how this is dealt with. Check this out.
A pretty big deal when you kill civilian contractors, because they're the ones rebuilding Iraq, by and large, not the U.S. military. They're the ones stringing the power lines, training the Iraqi National Police to the extent they can be trained, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think this is going to make it less likely that contractors are going to want to work in Iraq as they kill the killings on Wednesday?
You know, Tucker, you were there with me. You saw that there's a big diversity of the kinds of people that go into Iraq to do security. There are very high-end special operations experienced people, and then there are other people kind of getting onto this gold rush. There won't be a shortage of people to go to Iraq making that kind of money. There may be a shortage now of, or there may be fewer people who will think twice, you know, that will say, I don't know about that. We lost one in training the other day that after this incident decided that he didn't want to go. But I think that the men that come from the special operations community, this is what they're about. This is the way they are. They have a protector personality. That's not going to dissuade any of us from going.
But do you think the U.S. government has some interest in helping protect them maybe a little more?
No, they've stated that they don't have an interest.
But don't you? I'm fully aware. They said you're on your own.
Right.
But don't you think they, in real life, they do have a real interest in protecting them, because the country's going to fall apart without civilian contractors?
You're right. It will. The reconstruction effort would stop if you pull contractors out. In fact, if you even regulate them more than is currently being regulated, you know, as far as what they have to have done before they go over there, it would slow down the process. This is a mad rush to June. Let's not kid each other. That's what's going on here.
June being when authority will be transferred
exactly right
to someone, God knows who.
Yes.
Allah knows who, whoever.
Big rush.
Yahweh knows who.
Exactly.
In June.
So that we can turn it over. There has to be evidence of reconstruction advancement. And because of that, it's creating some dangerous situations.
Okay, we're going to take it.
Okay, here we go again. Now, here you have this guy talking about the country would fall apart if the civilian contractors were pulled out. Now, this is kind of amazing, because this is both hard and soft imperialism, to use Joe Nye's words. And what I mean by that is that you have all of these Iraqi people who have the means to help build back their country that's been destroyed by the imperialists in the first place. But the imperialists in this country want to hoard up all of the money and profits as possible. So they're sending two forms of contractors over there. A form of civilian contractors that are over there to help supposedly build back up the schools, do construction work, reinstall the electrical plants, you know, stuff like that. And then you have the hard imperialists, hard power protagonists, who are there to basically help maintain the order, i.e. these are the mercenaries, like the four that got shot. They were ex-Marine or ex-Navy SEAL guys. They got their ass shot off. Now, this is all about maintaining the privatized system of profit and the reconstruction of the economy of Iraq for the benefit of the imperialists. So, using some soft imperialists and some hard imperialism, the reality is that the Iraqi people, the Iraqi civilians, are still left out in the cold. They're the ones who are suffering. They're the ones who don't have any real destiny or control over their own destiny under the construct of what the imperialists are trying to maintain. Now, last on Crossfire, the host asked their guests during this what they call rapid fire session about the development and basically the soft and hard power strategies Sam should next take on. So as we wrap this up on this, let's see what they have to say. Do this.
These are crisp, and the answers even crisper, which means fast. Our guests are retired Major Dana Dillon of the Heritage Foundation, along with CNN contributor, security and terrorism expert, and all-around tough guy, Kelly McCann.
Major Dillon, when before the war, General Shinseki, Eric Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff at the time, testified before Congress that it would take a couple of 100,000 troops to occupy and pacify Iraq, Paul Wolfowitz, a pinhead professor who never served in the military, contradicted him and really insulted him. Doesn't Mr. Wolfowitz owe General Shinseki an apology now?
I don't know if he knows apologies. Obviously, Wolfowitz was correct in that, and so far it has worked out the way he wanted. I think General Shinseki's method maybe could have worked as well, but Wolfowitz's method is still working. I mean, people are killed, but people would have been killed with Shinseki's method as well. There have just been more soldiers there.
Kelly, you pointed out that on June 30th, the government, there's going to be a handover to someone. A year from then, June 30th, say 2005, what troop level, French level, do you think we'll have in Iraq?
Depends on if it's taken over by some kind of multinational force, and that's still a negotiation. Other forces are trying to be drawn in there for a variety of different reasons. But I don't think until there's going to be an influx of more contractors, that means more momentum, that means more security is needed. I don't think that there'll be less troops in the CIA.
Major Dillon, should we hand over authority to anybody in Iraq on June 30th?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of the problems that were brought up before is that the Iraqi police don't feel any... That doesn't belong to them. The problem with Fallujah doesn't belong to them. It belongs to the Americans. It's between the Americans and the people of Fallujah, which is not true. It is their problem. And when we hand it over to the Iraqis, then it becomes the problem of those police officers, not our problem.
Kelly, if I were a contractor in Iraq stuck at a red light and I saw someone even twitching in my direction, I'd shoot him immediately. That would be my instinct. Do you think we're going to see more of that happen? Contractors killing people?
Yeah, you can't not, especially after one of these incidents. Let's just hope that the people that are over there, and they do, they get in the right mindset, they do pre-deployment training, you get back familiar with your weapons, you get in the mindset. But let's face it, an AK-47 round travels about 3,250 feet per second. From the time you see the muzzle till the time a bullet's through you is how fast, like that. So the name of the game is quick.
Cool. Understand?
Great man. Major Dillon, thank you very much. Welcome to the Heritage Foundation.
Thanks, Pat.
Good to see both of you.
Thank you for an important discussion on a difficult topic.
Once again, this is justification. I mean, this is supposed to be a show of opposing views. One clown on the left, one clown on the right. Crossfire. What you see that is this friendly fire, just like soft imperialism or soft power versus hard power is still imperialism just the same. And it's all about justifying imperialism. So when you even hear these clowns talk about should Sam hand over authority to the Iraqis, here's an occupying, invading country talking about should we, quote-unquote, give even false the illusion of sovereignty over to the segment of the population that's willing to cooperate with us. Should we even do that? That's what he's saying. Or just ignore even that false pretense and just continue our hardcore policy, hard imperialism ways. And then the other clown, that Tucker Carlson guy on Crossfire, says that if he was a contractor, i.e. a mercenary in Iraq, and he saw someone twitch, he would just shoot him. Now here, you have a situation where this is the same mentality that you see take a place in the streets of America, where they come into our neighborhoods and they're declared as inner city danger zones. So this justifies them going in and using hard power tactics. And the end result is Amadou Diallo. The end result is Rampart Division situations. The end result is the Rider Police. Now, they use soft power in our neighborhoods in the form of, redlining and all that other type of, ethnic cleansing attempts type stuff. And then the police play the hard power. Death is a result either way. The difference is that just like in Iraq, it's time for a few more of them to be fallen in the streets of America. Hold on a sec.
RICO suit to be successful, you have to have an ongoing conduct. You have to have before, during, and after. And what you have here is the planning before, the failure to, the foreknowledge of the event, the failure to warn other people, the failure to prevent it, and then the event takes place. And after that, the obstruction of justice by the cover-up that has been taking place since that time. People just look at the facts. You know, like we just finished a four-day conference here in San Francisco, where it was an international conference. People came in from Japan, New Zealand, Canada, London, and around the world, and people all over the United States, researchers who have been researching this topic for the last 2 1/3 years. People should not have to have researched this topic as the main thrust. This should have been done by our government. As a, I've mentioned many times that if we brought in the television show CSI, we would have had a better investigation than we had here by our federal government into the events of 9/11. 9/11 could not have happened without the failure of 116 governmental agencies and fail-safe systems. The odds of that happening are 1 in 4 million. This government had foreknowledge of it going back at least to 1995, when, while investigating the 1993 attempt to blow up the World Trade Center, testimony came out that Al-Qaeda had planned to use planes to strike the Sears Tower in Chicago or the World Trade Center in New York. That's why even recently, as recent as last week, Condoleezza Rice and President Bush's statement that they had no idea that planes would ever be utilized in an attack on our country are out and out lies. And we have to hold them accountable for this. Some basics here that people can identify with, because what we're saying is pretty harsh, but it's true. The first thing people have to look at is what standard operating procedures were in place and not followed regarding what you do when planes are off course. The best identifying factor for your listeners is the fact that Payne Stewart, the golfer, 1 or 2 years before 9/11, his plane went off course, and the jets were notified within 3.5 minutes of after he went off course, and they were scrambled up to his plane within 8 minutes. And this is important significance because there are certain procedures to take place. And even with Payne Stewart, the word was, as we all watched it on national television as they followed the plane up to northern the United States, that if the plane was going to perhaps crash into a populated area, they had orders to shoot it down before it had crashed. Well, these events, these did not take place on 9/11. The first plane should never have been allowed to crash, because recently testimony came out that a stewardess was testifying from 8:20 a.m. that two other stewardesses or stewards on the plane had been stabbed already. The plane was hijacked. It was not in control of the pilot. And she spoke for 26 minutes until her voice ended when the plane struck the North Tower of the World Trade Center. Planes had been scrambled. That plane should never have hit the World Trade Center. But let's assuming argumentative that we said, well, even though we thought it could happen, we didn't know what happened because it never happened before. At 8:46, it wasn't until 17 minutes later that the second plane, which my client's husband, Neil Mariani, was on, struck the World Trade Center. There's no way that that plane should have ever been allowed into New York airspace or anywhere close enough to the World Trade Center with the knowledge of what the last plane had done. And Ellen and I have discussed this, and her husband probably would not be alive today, but that plane should have been in the Hudson River or some other place, but not in the World Trade Center, South Tower, which is the first tower that collapsed, killing many people and injuring many other individuals. So these have to be looked at. The second major issue that we have to look at is what happened with the World Trade Center building number 7, a building in the World Trade Center complex. Suddenly, it's a 47-story building built of concrete and steel, and suddenly on 9/11 at 5:30 in the afternoon, after no plane had struck it, fires only on several floors, the building suddenly imploded at 5:30. The question is why? So when you look at that issue, then you can deal with, after that, the issues of, you know, how or why the North and South Towers collapsed. So unconverted, true facts just indicate that the Bush administration was involved. The cover-up continues even to this day because they did not want the formulation of the 9/11 Commission. Then the 9/11 Commission was to be headed by Henry Kissinger, which they suddenly withdrew. 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans. If you don't ask the right questions, you'll never get the right answers. And they have not asked the right questions.
Well, once again, we've run out of time before commentaries and other things were able to be done. But whether you're dealing with soft power or hard power through the matrix of the U.S. or soft propaganda versus hard propaganda, the game in America is still the same. Expansionism and domination and subjugation against and for us. What we're going to have to do is grind against it. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.
The motherfucking God we trust is on a dollar. That's the only dude they're talking about.
Every day is a struggle, how to hustle some dough. If you was raised in the hood, well, then you already know. Hippie days, it'd be good, but mostly money be slow. Have you ever been hungry before?
Deep in his frequency.
Steady on the grind. Steady on the grind. Cause I got to.